From Community Public Radio, this is CPR Sunday. In New York, I'm Don DeBar, and this week we speak with Eric Dreitzer, political commentator and host of the website StopImperialism.org. Eric, welcome back. Pleasure as always. Hope you enjoyed your time at the Left Forum last week.
Don, thank you for having me back. Left Forum is interesting. Great talk, good panel that we had, couple of them, on Venezuela and Latin America. Always interesting to pay admission to an event where you're the speaker.
Well, one of the speakers.
Yeah.
Very important one, however. I mean, that you get free here.
Yeah. Thank God for CPR.
Yeah. All right, let's take a look around the global landscape. Where you want to start?
Well, I'd like to start in South Asia, if we could, because unfortunately, I think that with global developments happening as they are, particularly in Latin America and in Eastern Europe and in Europe generally, I think that too often our focus is really geared towards these hot spots around the world, and we forget that some of the most important developments globally are happening in Asia. They're happening in South Asia, and they're geopolitically, I think, not just significant, but in many ways transformative. And so I think that to a large extent, ignoring South Asia is really doing a disservice to understanding what's happening globally. So where I'd like to start is an interesting story that came out this past week, I believe from the Pakistani press, although it was picked up in a number of places. And this has to do with the Iranian port of Chabahar. Chabahar is this important new coastal port in Iran that is in many ways seen as a critical cooperation deal between Iran and India. India has signed on as one of the major developers of the Chabahar port. And so, and it's, again, this is the critical piece of all of this. Chabahar is seen as the rival to the port at Gwadar in Pakistan, which is being developed by the Chinese. So you can already see sort of the geopolitical and strategic fault lines here. Chabahar in Iran being developed by the Indians, Gwadar in Pakistan being developed by the Chinese. Of course, Pakistan and China have this longstanding relationship, so that's sort of unsurprising. But the Chabahar question is really interesting. And so the reason I bring it up is because this story that came out this past week was in many ways, I think, quite headline grabbing or earth shaking as far as these developments go, because it's now come out that according to certain sources, the Iranians and the Indians perhaps are willing to actually take on additional partners for the Chabahar port, potentially even open to Pakistan and or China getting involved in the development game in Chabahar. Now, that is incredibly significant for a number of reasons. I think first and foremost, because it is a means of fostering relations between the two Asian giants, China and India. And also, it really undermines what I believe to be the one of the guiding forces of U.S. foreign policy and U.S. Geopolitics and geopolitical strategy for the region, where Washington really wants to be able to divide Asia, to split India and China away from each other, to pull India into the U.S. orbit, pry it away from the Chinese, away from the Shanghai Cooperation Organization / BRICS countries. And
yeah, let me just say something on that point.
Yeah, go ahead.
Because there's an interesting article at Pakistan Defense, which is a defense.pk website, and it's called India's Expanding Chabahar's Port Facility to Counter Gwadar Port. In it, they have a little piece that says, the geopolitical and economic intrigue currently underway in Baluchistan fits into what is sometimes called the New Great Game, making reference to the original one in the 19th century between the UK or Britain and Russia for influence there. As before, the geopolitical considerations can be intricate. According to Wikipedia, this article says, the New Great Game involves competition between the US, UK, and NATO, other NATO countries, against Russia, China, and other SCO organizations. Now, for influence, power, and hegemony in Central Asia and the Transcaucasus. Now, what's interesting to me about this, of course, is the U.S. is way the hell over here, the U.K. is way the hell up there with the other NATO countries, and Russia and China and India and Pakistan and Iran are all in Central Asia and or the Transcaucasus. Like, they belong there for power and influence. These other characters are coming in to take over, basically.
I mean, it's exactly what we would expect, Don. That's pretty much how the United States and the British, the imperial powers, how they really operate. Obviously, the U.S. is nowhere near the South China Sea, but the U.S. still sees the Asia Pacific as its sphere of influence and seeks to contain, isolate, and or intimidate to the extent possible China. So it really, I guess, is par for the course. But, you know, what I think the U.S. is really concerned about is less the actual infrastructure development, although they don't love that either. But what I think they're really concerned about is the increased potential for cooperation between these countries. That's really, I think, the thing that keeps the strategic planners in Washington, this Zbigniew Brzezinski and his acolytes, up at night, is thinking that Russia and China really form an actual alliance as opposed to just a marriage of economic convenience, that India and China bury the hatchet on their numerous issues over the decades and become more partners than adversaries. These are the kinds of developments that, from the Washington perspective, are terrifying. And so when you see a port like Chabahar, which is really in many ways one of the most important infrastructure projects in South Asia, when you see something like that, obviously that gives pause. And for Chabahar to potentially be a source of cooperation between China, India, Iran, and Pakistan, I mean, that really touches on some of the largest and most critical geopolitical issues in the world. Obviously, the India-China rivalry, obviously, China's One Belt, One Road version of economic development versus India's engagement in Central Asia, in particular Afghanistan. So there's a number of issues at play, and that excerpt that you had alluded to from that article touched even on Balochistan, and Balochistan is a really important issue to understand. Balochistan, for listeners, is the province that is split between eastern Iran and western Pakistan, and this is the province in which, or the territory in which the Gwadar port is on the coast, as well as some of the most active and some of the most brutal terrorist organizations in the region, including the Lashkar-e-Jangvi, the Lashkar-e-Taiba, the Jundallah on the Iranian side of the border, and a number of other terror groups. And this is where we've seen some of these really awful massacres and killings of the Hazara ethnic minority, the Shia Muslims in Pakistan. So there are a number of key issues in regards just to Balochistan that really bring all of this into stark relief. So on the one hand, we see Chabahar increasingly becoming a source of cooperation. On the other hand, we see continued destabilization in Balochistan. The security question is really the main thing holding back Chinese development at the Gwadar port, because the Gwadar port is only relevant and significant insofar as it is connected by infrastructure, roads and rails primarily, to not only the rest of Pakistan, but really what, for the Chinese perspective, north up through Pakistan, through that corridor, and into western China towards the Xinjiang province. So that strategic calculus from the Gwadar side needs to be expanded to an understanding of Chabahar, because Chabahar in many ways follows a similar development path in regards to northern connectivity, specifically the Indians seeing Chabahar port as as the what could we call it, the foothold to the South Asia space, and particularly to exports coming out of Afghanistan. India is a major player in the post-occupation Afghan landscape that is beginning to emerge, particularly iron ore, other minerals, and various other exports. Chabahar is central to India's strategy for Afghanistan. That's why this cooperation and or collaboration is so interesting.
Yeah, I mean, you have, let's see, just between China and India, about half of the global population. In this area, you have Iran, and then, you know, to the south and west of Iran, the other major energy providers, and this entire region being a transport area for, including these projects, among other things, energy, much of the world's energy. And yeah. So everybody is positioning for control of that. And, you know, you mentioned the U.S. Seeing this as, you know, just in, strictly in geopolitical, you know, power relations, the possibility of, you know, deeper integration between Russia and China, you know, strategic purposes. But also, you know, the business interests that are driving this, that they like to play monopoly with them as the board and the pieces. And these other people are, you know, building an independent economic megilla. And, you know, these guys are cut out at the moment. You mentioned China, Pakistan, India, you know, Russia, all of these, Iran. And that, you know, if they're doing business together as one, the United States is and the EU are not part of that.
Yeah, exactly. And this is really, you know, you were alluding to earlier the great game. I mean, this is part of the great game of the 21st century. And that's why it's on the one hand so interesting. On the other hand, it can be quite dangerous because the kind of development that you're seeing happening in Asia, and to be fair, a lot of it is under the auspices of China. I mean, a lot of the projects that we're seeing in Asia generally and in South Asia specifically probably wouldn't even be on the board were it not for the One Belt, One Road / New Silk Road / right. Maritime Silk Road strategy that the Chinese are employing. And so that is, I think, something that is certainly you know, on the radar for Washington. And obviously, that's what informs a lot of Washington's policies. When the U.S. sees China moving to develop these kind of relations, to develop these sorts of projects, that, of course, motivates the U.S. to really, you know, step on the gas when it comes to the Asia pivot, when it comes to ginning up anti-China attitudes in Southeast Asia among the ASEAN grouping, when it comes to the South China Sea dispute. So all of these issues, you know, whether it's the, you know, the ones that I just mentioned, whether it's China-Japan tensions in the East China Sea, whether it's the North Korea's issue, whether it's Southeast Asia, all of these issues have as the backdrop this larger competition between Chinese economic development and the U.S. attempts to maintain and to further hegemony. That's, I think, the crux of this dispute. But to bring it back to this question of the ports and of Balochistan, I think that this is really critical because, you know, I've written about it and talked about it, although not that much recently. But Balochistan is really, I think, one of the hot spots globally. It is a crossroads of sorts because Balochistan really is sort of, from the Chinese perspective, Gwadar and Balochistan is their foothold in the Indian Ocean, that basin area. And so for the Chinese, that is critical because it allows them overland access to the Indian Ocean, allowing them to bypass the Straits of Malacca, which is one of the critical global choke points. So for China, it's really a matter of economic security and perhaps also potentially national security that they're able to develop the Gwadar port. But as I mentioned earlier, that can't be fully developed if the situation as far as security in Balochistan doesn't improve. That's why China's pressing so hard on their Pakistani allies to really bring down the hammer in Balochistan and and get it under control. That is an insurgency, a terrorist insurgency that has been off and on for a number of years. And, oh, by the way, the United States foments and stokes that insurgency. I remember, you know, Dana Rohrabacher, representative from Southern California. He's one of the most outspoken members of Congress in favor of quote unquote Balochi independence and Balochi self-determination. Well, gee, it just so happens that that's the same place and the same congressman who was taking photographs with the Mujahideen in 1979 in the same regions with the same individuals. And for what purpose? For use against the Soviets. And so fast forward 35 years later, we see the same individuals ginning up the same kind of terror war for the purposes of bringing down China and Chinese involvement in the region. So there's a lot of similarities, a lot of commonalities that we can look at from U.S. strategic perspective in this region. And then also, it has to be said, it is believed that Balochistan has massive mineral deposits under the earth, that it has potentially also energy deposits underneath Balochistan. So there's a number of issues that sort of come together to paint this picture of this particular region, which, of course, strategically makes sense why the U.S. would focus on it so much. It is part of Iran, and it is part of Pakistan, two countries that are really critical for very different reasons to U.S. political and geopolitical objectives. And I think that all of that really needs to be sort of integrated into an understanding of these issues.
And you have, as you mentioned, the U.S. basically looking in geostrategic terms to hamstring China's access through these, through this whole corridor, really. Because if you look that way, you have access, to the energy in the region, access westward, continuing the Silk Road towards Europe, and also access towards Africa. And these are all places where the U.S., sees itself and the EU in competition with China, and this would knock a lot of stones at one time.
Oh, that's 100% right, and thank you for bringing that up, because just pull out your maps or your mental maps and consider. We know that China is investing somewhere on the order of about $200 billion in Africa, okay? It's far outstripping any other individual competitor not named the United States, and actually outstripping the United States as well. So if you think about it, the Chinese exports that are coming out of Africa, the raw materials, the other goods, you look at the map, they have to travel a significant distance, and they have to travel through the Straits of Malacca, around through the South China Sea to get to the Chinese ports to bring those goods into the Chinese mainland. Now, the port at Gwadar would fundamentally change that entire trade formula. It would allow the Chinese to get the goods from Africa, unload them on the Pakistani coast, bypassing the Straits of Malacca, bypassing the South China Sea, and bring them directly into China via rail and or highway. And so that actually is quite transformative when you think about global trade networks and China's ability to really engage in a even more direct way with Africa. So
there's also a domestic consideration, because what you have basically in the savings in transportation costs that would be part of this once constructed, you can amortize that and use it to finance the development of the roads and railways.
Yeah, and that's exactly what they're doing, and that's really the main, look. The thing that's holding up the Gwadar port is not Chinese investment. The Chinese got plenty of money for the investment. The problem is the Chinese aren't willing to invest heavily in Gwadar until the security situation is a bit more under control, because, of course, to spend hundreds of billions of dollars or whatever it would be to develop to develop Gwadar and the roads and the rails and all of that, emerging from that obviously would make it an easy soft target. And we have already security issues that are, you know, security guarantees. The Pakistani government has their military forces guarding a lot of these Chinese investments in Gwadar. But of course, that's not a long-term solution. And so I would argue that some, at least, of the terrorism and the quote-unquote insurgency that's happening in Balochistan is either directly or tangentially related to U.S. intelligence machinations and to British machinations. Obviously, we know historically the CIA and MI6 are deeply involved in Balochistan. As I mentioned, the Mujahideen issue. Also, of course, we can point to the Indian intelligence services who have been accused by Pakistani government and Pakistani officials of being directly involved in fomenting and supporting some of this terror war. So there's this sort of irregular war that's ongoing in Balochistan, which again complicates this picture. So then when we shift our focus a little bit to Chabahar and we look at the issues surrounding that, I can see why it would seem an attractive scenario, obviously, for the Chinese and potentially also for Pakistan as a way of undermining India and preventing India from having sole, let's call it, monopoly control over that all-important port.
You know, I alluded to the relationship between the economic and the political and military considerations before by, you know, pointing out that the U.S. business interests are likely not happy about the competition that would be developing there. But also, you have the potential of harnessing that being offered here by the offer to bring in everybody else as partners in the region in the development of the Iranian port. And perhaps if India and Pakistan, for example, were sitting in the same sandbox making money together, you know, the antagonisms would dissipate some.
Well, that's exactly the point. That's why that's part of the reason why I'm bringing it up, is because there is certainly that potential. Now, I don't want to rain on the parade that I seem to be the grand marshal of here, but the issue is, do we really believe that this is going to happen? That's the thing that's bothering me, is I'm not convinced yet that just because this potential is there and just because they're writing about it and saying it in print doesn't necessarily mean that this is going to happen. Obviously, we have decades of antagonism between India and Pakistan, between India and China, and actually the Iran-Pakistan relationship has been fraught with a lot of problems for many years, although it seems to be improving. So we, on the one hand, we want to assess it and understand it and understand the implications. On the other hand, we don't want to overstate what's at least at the moment happening, because everything that we're saying as far as cooperation among these countries vis-a-vis Chabahar might not actually happen.
Yeah, I mean, and of course, you know, you've been going around, you know, describing basically the circumference of this mixture of issues between the terrorist insurgencies that exist in the countries we're describing. And the historical antipathy between some of them, and the geopolitical game, of course, with the U.S. exacerbating all of those things. But maybe you could actually map out the multidimensional landscape, including those things. In other words, there's three or four major areas where this competition is taking place, somehow you have to imagine that they're all connected on one side or the other.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, there's a couple of issues I think that need to be sort of addressed here. On the one hand, And really, China is kind of the elephant in the room, because on the one hand, you have China and the One Belt, One Road strategy really building towards connectivity between Asia, really across Eurasia, from Asia all the way to Europe. And that includes these rail connections through Central Asia, which make the former Soviet republics of Central Asia critical to Chinese development. That includes Russia and the Russia-sponsored Eurasian Economic Union, to the extent that that's even really a relevant grouping. That's debatable. And, a number of other projects. But it's not simply about connecting Eurasia. If it were, that would make the One Belt, One Road, New Silk Road a bit, dare I say, one-dimensional. But actually, it's much larger than that, because it also includes development in Southeast Asia and development on the Indian subcontinent and development in South Asia generally, particularly, you know, some of these issues we've been talking about. And that, of course, connects to Africa, Chinese investments in Africa. So really, on the overland side, you have China really pushing its economic influence all the way across Asia and towards Europe, trying to basically challenge for access to that European marketplace with Chinese exports. On the other hand, you also have the maritime Silk Road, or these maritime developments that include the much touted, the quote-unquote string of pearls strategy, which the Chinese have established these outposts, either military or commercial outposts, all throughout the Indian Ocean, spreading from Asia towards Africa, allowing China to have this sort of hopscotch, hopping from one spot to the next on their route from China to Africa. And then all of this is, again, about energy, about minerals, about raw materials, exports, all of that. So these two, they're not competing, they're sort of complementary paths of Chinese economic development. That is what the U.S. is seeking to block as much as it can. That's what the Trans-Pacific Partnership is about in Southeast Asia and in the Asia Pacific generally, and that's what U.S. strategy in Africa is about, blocking the Chinese from having access to these African investments. That's why, more than any other reason, why the United States has so many military facilities all throughout Africa. That's really the focus of AFRICOM, despite what they say is their official mission statement. So I think that in thinking about all of these issues related to Chinese economic development vis-a-vis Asia and Africa, you have to consider the role of these ports, you have to consider the role of infrastructure development, and you have to consider the political circumstances that are presenting obstacles to those developments, as I mentioned in Balochistan and elsewhere.
Yeah, you know, and then there's this military dimension to that that you're seeing. You describe some of the terrorist groups, for example, and you have no doubt that these are groups that have sponsors, among the great game players. And so that's part of the military strategy. You have the U.S. Entering into these agreements with India, for example. You have all the stuff going on in the South China Sea for anything that goes through there. And then you have AFRICOM on the ground in Africa. And there's other things. You have, at any moment, the slightest provocation could provoke military action between India and Pakistan, between India and China, et cetera, et cetera. You know, it was waiting for somebody to push a button in Langley.
Yeah.
And then in the midst of that,
U.S. military forces in Australia.
Of course.
U.S. military forces in the Philippines.
Everywhere. I mean, in South Korea, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, exactly.
But then with all of that, you have China last week. Sending a naval task force, basically, of three ships to Cape Town, and that was more sort of a debut of the Chinese Navy there, and it was done very publicly, and they had involved the people of Cape Town in something like a Fleet Week type activities, and brought out the Chinese community there as well, and. So I'm wondering, I'm looking at that in the context we're describing as, the positioning of military hardware in the rear, and wondering if China isn't going to be looking for deeper military cooperation and or integration with South Africa.
Absolutely. And quite frankly, it's not just South Africa. Let's not forget that China just recently took over control of that important base in Djibouti,
right,
which gives the Chinese sort of a military foothold on the Horn of Africa, which is really important for China because it allows China to have military access and or military guarantees, let's call it, of commercial access through the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, which is that all-important choke point that separates Africa from the Arabian Peninsula, very important for access to the Red Sea, very important for access to any exports that are coming out of East Africa, or particularly from the Horn of Africa. At one point, it was Sudanese oil that was really the main focus for the Chinese. Now it's much more diversified, and obviously the problems in Sudan have made that more complicated as well. But in any case, yes, absolutely. And the Chinese military making an appearance in South Africa is yet another indication of what I've argued before, why South Africa is, and the ANC government in South Africa, which I'm not really a fan of generally, but why the ANC government led by Jacob Zuma, why that's being targeted, in my view, by the United States and the West generally for destabilization. Because despite their sort of acquiescence to neoliberal capitalism and to finance capital and to enriching their partners in the West, they have increasingly turned towards China. You even have China being Chinese being offered in primary and in secondary schools, language classes, I mean, in South Africa now. You have massive investment from the Chinese in various sectors of the economy, including mining, which is an all-important driver of the South African economy. That's why the U.S., and financiers in the U.S. on Wall Street and in the city of London, that's why they're focused on doing what they can to stir up political conflict in South Africa, because the Democratic Alliance, the DA, led by the quote-unquote Africa's Obama, this guy Maimane, the DA is even more neoliberal, even more pro-U.S. and pro-U.K., even more pro-Western than the ANC. And so if they can destabilize and get rid of a pro-Chinese government that has made much of their inclusion in the BRICS and replace them with an anti-Chinese pro-US government, well, that would have obviously significant ramifications. And so when the Chinese Navy makes an appearance in Cape Town, it's not just to demonstrate military force, it's to demonstrate political support.
Yeah, it's an interesting fact on the side, of course, that both China and South Africa are part of the BRICS, and we've discussed in some depth the attack on the BRICS grouping, and we've witnessed in past weeks the attack on the B in BRICS, in particular the coup that's been underway in Brazil for a while. The things that happened in Africa over the past 5-6 years, during the Obama administration, almost exclusively, but primarily for sure, the taking out of both the Gbagbo in Cote d'Ivoire and then the murder of Gaddafi, both very strong advocates for African unity, and with Gaddafi willing to bankroll it, and very strong advocates of, against imperialism. And so Zuma at the UN Security Council, when they authorized a no-fly zone, which ended up authorizing a war on Libya, Zuma sat on his hands. They allowed it to happen. And I'm wondering if he's not paying the price for some of that now. But you see parallels to what has unfolded in Africa, to what is unfolding in Latin America now. I wondered if you wanted to talk about that some.
Yeah, absolutely. Let me get to the point about Zuma really quickly. I agree with you that is what happened, and it's shameful and reprehensible. But even at the time, Zuma had made at least some motions towards trying to broker a deal. Remember, Zuma got in his jet and tried to fly to Libya right in the midst of all of that, right before the NATO bombing began,
the AU
in hopes of brokering a deal.
Yep, and the AU as well. And the AU said, don't bomb and don't attack Libya, basically. And that was completely ignored, of course.
Of course, but that illustrates, I think, some of the complexity of the political relations in Africa. And that, I think, also demonstrates kind of what I was getting at a minute ago about the ties between South Africa and neoliberal capital. Because if it wasn't so deeply interconnected with finance capital and with Wall Street and the IMF and all of the rest of these institutions, if it had been more independent economically, if it had already fostered deeper relations with China and with Russia and with other countries, Brazil, India, so forth, if that had been the case, Zuma might have felt a little bit more bold, a little bit more confident in really opposing what was happening in Libya rather than just kind of paying lip service to it. So that's sort of the complexity here. But your question, I think, is spot on, because what we're seeing in Latin America in many ways parallels Africa. Now, it's different, to be sure. In Africa, a lot of the problems in North Africa and in West Africa are directly connected to the war on Libya. We haven't seen a direct U.S. war in Latin America that has precipitated a lot of other problems.
Obviously, they feel freer. They feel freer to, basically to kill leaders in Africa than they do in Latin America. If they were to do a Gaddafi on Maduro, for example, there would be an uprising across the region.
Absolutely. And part of that is the legacy of Chavez, the integration processes that have taken place in Latin America, which are obviously far more advanced and far more developed than any integration processes in Africa are or were when Gaddafi was there. So, yes, but the parallel is important because in Latin America, we have seen a specific and targeted attempt to destroy any left-leaning, unity-oriented, integration-oriented, dare I say, Bolivarian-oriented governments in Latin America, from Brazil and the Workers' Party there to Cristina Fernandez's party in Argentina being replaced by Mauricio Macri, who is really, he has really emerged as the leading edge of Wall Street's aggression in Latin America. I mean, he, from the very moment that he's come into office, he has really, I think, taken the reins of the right-wing counter-revolution in Latin America from the word go. He was on the phone with people on Wall Street settling the dispute with Paul Singer. He has been vocal in wanting to boot Venezuela out of the Mercosur grouping. He has been very bold as far as his comments about Brazil, about Venezuela, and about how Latin America should move forward. And so, we've seen these governments being replaced. And obviously, there was this move in Bolivia to block a third term for Evo Morales, which complicates the situation there, particularly as commodities prices continue to fall. We've seen these shifts in governments. We've seen a breaking up of what integration processes did exist. And that's what you saw in Africa. Target number one was Gaddafi, not simply because Libya had oil, not simply because Libya was developing itself, not simply because Libya was historically antagonistic to a large extent with the United States, although in recent years less so, but it was really about Libya and Gaddafi's role in fostering an integration process in Africa, an integration process that was being bankrolled by oil revenues, that was meant to allow Africa a sense of independence away from the United States, independence away from the former colonial, or I would say current colonial powers in Europe as well. And so this move to destroy integration processes, that's where I really see the parallel between Africa and Latin America. And obviously in Africa, they have much less means of resisting.
Yeah, there are definitely differences in the methodology that was applied in Africa to the one being employed in South America. But there are also some similarities, too. The mode of replacing the leaders arguably different from, rape and murder by hired thugs, basically. With Gaddafi, with the removal of Gbagbo from the presidential palace at gunpoint by French troops, the old colonial power, to the election of Macri, the impeachment of Rousseff, the constant pressure on Maduro, etc. But you also have some very stark similarities, because after the change of leadership was accomplished, you had the installation of AFRICOM in Africa, and you're now seeing the reinstallation of SOUTHCOM into Latin America with Macri, last week when he was in Beijing, or his foreign minister was in Beijing and his economic minister were in Beijing, and they were doing all these deals with China. Also had negotiated for the U.S. to put one base in southern Argentina and working on the details of another that would be positioned to deal with Brazil, Peru, you know, all of that whole area, including Bolivia.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I agree with you. And actually, in some instances, we even see similarities. Like, for instance, the situation in Bolivia, right? In Bolivia, you had a referendum for the purposes of amending the constitution to allow for an additional term for Evo Morales. That is there's a lot of talk in Bolivia and in Latin America about potential outside interference in that referendum. But in any case, that is almost identical to the situation that we've seen in Burundi in the last year, where you had this you had an attempt by a president to seek an additional term that was denied by judicial elements that are perhaps it's been alleged backed by international forces. You had obviously an NGO outcry about the situation in Burundi that has devolved into some violence. So there are some similarities, this sort of use of this procedural legalistic means of removing a president that is increasingly independent, a president that is increasingly focused on fostering ties with China, with non-Western actors. That parallel, I think, works pretty well between Latin America and Africa.
Yeah, and there are other places too. So, but looking at all of that, I'm wondering if we're not seeing the future of Latin America as planned in Langley or the Pentagon or whatever, in the present condition of Africa.
In a sense, I think that that's correct. I mean, obviously, the gains that have been made in the last 15, 16 years that the United States would like to roll back. Obviously, politically speaking, they would like to put in place their proxies to run these countries in the way that they have done all throughout Africa. I mean, if you think about it, Africa, there are really, I mean, you know, depending on how you look at it, really only two countries that are truly independent. That is to say that they are independent not only of military occupation by the United States, but really independent economically. And obviously they struggle tremendously for various reasons. But Zimbabwe and Eritrea are really the only two countries. Every other country has some U.S. military presence, has a large degree of Western financial presence. And so, yes, I think that we are seeing definitely a parallel here. Now, Latin America, the situation in Latin America is also vastly different than it is in Africa. Latin America has a lot of other interests at play. It has a very different history. But in terms of commodities, Latin American countries, just like African countries, are very heavily dependent upon commodity exports. They are very much impacted by the fall in commodity prices. And I think that that issue is really what is exacerbating all of these political problems. And needless to say, Langley and Washington are exploiting them.
You know, you have an interesting correlation also. you know, classically we would refer to it in terms of race, quote unquote. But you actually have, if you look at the African diaspora, which is very well represented in Latin America, particularly Brazil, for example, you're talking basically about Africans that are inside of Latin America as a potential bloc. And if you look at the interim president in Brazil, for example, one of the first things that he did away, you know, one of the first institutions that he did away with was targeting the issues that have evolved in Brazil as against the African diaspora there, which is, again, very large. And also his cabinet, of course, being full of white men.
Yeah, and that is reflective of a historical tendency in Latin America among the right-wing elites to not only completely ignore the issues related to Africans and the African diaspora, but actually to exhibit the kind of racism that we associate in the U.S. with white supremacy, with neocolonial attitudes. Obviously, people like Temer and Macri and others in Latin America, they really see themselves as quote-unquote Europeans, right? They see themselves as white-skinned right. Europeans in Latin America. They certainly do not associate themselves with the quote-unquote lesser peoples of Africa. Remember the kind of abuse right. that Chavez got and Maduro right. has gotten right. in Venezuela from the right-wing elites. They call Chavez a monkey right. and an ape and a gorilla. They say Maduro the burro, Maduro right. the donkey, right. right? So these are racially tinged, not just tinged, I mean, these are overtly racist epithets that they use to describe these leaders. And the same thing in Brazil with Rousseff and the Workers' Party, the same thing all over Latin America. So yes, absolutely, the racial element is there, but the race element is, of course, and I mean, I know you know this, but I'm saying for listeners, the race issue is, of course, intimately connected with class. I mean, these things are not separable. And historically in Latin America, it is the white-skinned Europeans who have been at the top economically, who have owned all the best land. I mean, in Brazil, for instance, you know, vast swaths of land for cattle ranching, vast swaths of land of agriculture and so forth are owned by a tiny minority. This is true across the world, really, in the global south, where you have a small minority that benefited from colonialism that in varying degrees and in various ways are still very much in the driver's seat. So,
and you have that also, that's a small minority even of so-called whites, of Europeans, although there are privileges that extend to much of the rest of the class, or at least are perceived as doing it and used as motivators. But if you're looking at it, at the African diaspora there as Africans, and you're thinking in terms of, strategic pushback, you have this racial, cultural, and social, and political and reality construct to use as a toy to do that. But I think if you look at it now, you can see that the same game was played in the original colonization of Africa, where you had both military activity and economic seizures on the continent itself, and the demonization of the diaspora, which, by the way, was made a diaspora more or less at the point of a gun or a sword as well.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think we should be conscious of the fact that a lot of the problems that still exist in these places, you know, problems of racism, problems of poverty, and all of the rest of that, these are not simply national problems. These are problems of colonialism. These are the problems that were fostered by colonialism. And that's why, to a large extent, when we look at a lot of these issues in the global south, the word neocolonialism has to be in our lexicon, because it is in many ways neocolonialism, as you mentioned earlier in our conversation, Don, the removal of Gbagbo at the point of a gun, the removal of Zelaya in Honduras at the point of a gun, the removal of the government in Paraguay, for that matter, essentially at the point of a gun in right. 2012. Obviously Gaddafi, and we could point to a number of other examples. This is how the forces of neocolonialism have reasserted themselves in these spheres of influence that they've traditionally traditionally controlled and that in recent years have been moving in a more independent direction. And that's really part of the, you know, quote unquote, great game that we see all over the world, is the attempt by the colonial powers and by the empire itself today, headed by the United States, to assert or reassert their hegemony, particularly in places where they've historically had it and have lost it, or at least it's been undermined and weakened in recent years. And this question about the black diaspora is, I think, a really good one, because it really, I think, translates politically. The Workers' Party in Brazil, for instance, for all of their flaws, which were many, including a lot of their policies in places like Haiti, which were deeply exploitative, and it has to be said, they definitely colluded with neoliberal capital in various ways, in various places. But the Workers' Party was a party of the working class and a party of the poor. They were more representative of those strata of society than they were the wealthy white-skinned elites. And that's really part of what put a bullseye on their back, because it's not just the racial hatred towards the dark-skinned peoples of the lower classes. It's also an economic vision of reality. These people see Brazil as belonging to them, not belonging to the masses of working people and masses of Afro-Brazilians and the rest of that, but belonging to them. And that's the kind of threat that Chavez and Bolivarianism really represented. It represented a threat to the established order economically, politically, and socially and culturally. It was a threat to white supremacy, to neocolonial dominance, and that is absolutely true of Gaddafi in Africa as well. Gaddafi represented a threat to neocolonialism. All those countries in West Africa that are using basically the French currency, that are still speaking in French, that are still in many ways colonies of France, all of those countries looked at Gaddafi like a hero, because Gaddafi represented a path towards real independence. The same is true in Latin America. All of those peoples in Brazil and in Colombia, the Afro-Colombians, the Afro-Brazilians, the people of Guyana and elsewhere, so many millions of people in Latin America looked at Chavez as a hero, because he represented an assault on that established order, the order of neocolonialism. And of course, the loss of Chavez, I mean, it's incalculable.
And he ended up dead.
Yeah, well, that's right.
Yeah. You have in the Western Hemisphere still Castro's and Cuba in general, and Daniel Ortega and Nicaragua in general. It's a pretty stable place.
How stable will Nicaragua be if they don't complete the Chinese Canal, though?
Well, it's an interesting question. Certainly that's being meddled with to the extent possible.
Exactly.
You have also Correa is terming out. You have Evo Morales, who's going to be terming out. And in Africa, you have Mugabe, and I don't know who else really in Africa.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of the problem. Gaddafi was really the leader of Africa in that regard, and it's an open question who will lead Zimbabwe after Mugabe's dead. I think that specifically, there are definitely attempts by the U.S. and the U.K. to put in place the MDCT, the Movement for Democratic Change, and Morgan Tsvangirai and that faction, which is historically connected to the United States and to the British. Whether or not the people of Zimbabwe and the ZANU-PF Party are actually going to accept that, I doubt it. Right. Does that mean we have a civil war in that country yet again? It's entirely possible. You have countries in Africa that have been created out of whole cloth,
right,
by the United States.
And even recently, right, South Sudan. I mean, and you've had, if you go back to the end of the original colonial period, or the struggles that were taking place in the 50s and 60s, when you had Patrice Lumumba in Congo, and that government under siege by the United States, eventually taken down by the U.S. and by Brussels. The Katanga province was removed from Congo. There was the entire civil war for secession of that, and it ended up involving the UN and such. And now, again, you have someone from Katanga that is just been exposed as hiring mercenaries that were put there by the U.S. while they conduct war in the DR Congo.
Yeah, exactly. And let's not forget, I mean, if we're going to talk about Congo, you can't speak about the war in Congo, the genocide in the Congo, without talking about Rwanda, right, without talking about the U.S. role in financing the regime in Rwanda, in finance, which in turn is financing a lot of these militant groups, like not just M23, but a number of others that are operating around near, you know, in the Congo, in the East Kivu provinces, which is generating massive wealth for Kagame and his regime in Rwanda. Interestingly, there was very little outcry about Kagame's power play to go extra constitutional and get an additional term to his presidency or his dictatorship. Very little outcry about that. I mean, there was some, but, you know, it
here.
Sort of got swept under the rug.
Yeah.
Interesting how that happens.
Yeah, finally, what do you see as the prospects in each case?
Well, you mean in Latin America and Africa?
Yeah, exactly. And you know, put it this way, what would you suggest as a pushback strategy from Africa and Latin America?
Well, for the African countries, they have to continue moving in an economically independent direction. That means increased cooperation with China. That means bringing along other trading partners to the extent that they can. That means also trying to develop themselves internally in various ways. There's a growing sense that in Africa, the human capacity, the human development is improving to the point where there is going to be Africa is very young in the sense of demographically. You have masses of young people all throughout the global south. In places like Nigeria and South Africa and Kenya and other parts of the continent, there are younger people who are emerging to be, who have a bit more education than previous generations, who have more exposure to the rest of the world. I mean, this new generation are going to need to be the ones who are going to develop these countries, but none of that's going to happen without some kind of financial backing. That's really what Gaddafi was about. That's what Libya was doing. That's why the role that Libya played has to somehow be replaced. You look at a country like Eritrea, which is focused so heavily on self-development and indigenous improvement, you see that it is a limited process when you don't have outside funding, and your options at this point are very limited. It's either the IMF and the World Bank, or it's China, pretty much. And, to a lesser degree, perhaps this new BRICS Development Bank, to the extent that that's going to get involved in things in Africa. So these institutions like the BRICS Development Bank and others, these have to evolve, have to develop in order to provide a real legitimate alternative to Western finance capital. Is it an alternative to capitalism? No, it's another kind of capitalism. It's a capitalism with its centers in the non-Western world. But if you're a country in Africa or you're a country in Latin America, particularly the ones that are in the crosshairs of the empire, well, that is obviously pretty attractive. And so that process needs to increase. The process of cooperation politically, economically, and militarily needs to increase. That's what you're seeing in terms of China in Venezuela, China in Latin America, and as you mentioned earlier, Don, China in South Africa as well, and China in Djibouti and elsewhere. These things have to evolve as well, so that what we look at 10, 15 years from now is a continuation of these integration processes rather than having to restart them after the U.S. has reasserted itself.
And on that note, Eric, thank you very much. Pleasure as always.
Thanks, Don.
You've been listening to CPR Sunday. I'm Don DeBar, your host, and look forward to seeing you again next week.